Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We are almost at the July 4th holiday, which I think we need because I really have this feeling that everybody is in the process of losing their minds. You know, and look, I understand I wrote a book, How the Right Lost Its Mind, but I mean everybody has lost their mind. I was DMing back and forth with Matt Lewis this morning and, you know, asking, you know, is there something in the water that's happening right now? So, you know, who else to talk about the growing insanity of American politics other than Sarah Longwell and Bill Kristol?
So, you know, July 4th would normally be a nice respite, except, of course, we're all going to be going out of our minds July 4th as Trump tries to ruin the Washington, D.C. July 4th celebration with his intruding himself and the tanks and all that. So I don't know that we get any break from the madness, Charlie.
Yeah, and we'll be lighting our sneakers on fire, our flag sneakers on fire. The tanks will be rolling in. The Democrats will be lurching far left. The Republicans will be going, you know, MAGA crazy. It's a weird world these days.
You know, that was a good riff, by the way. I have a feeling we have a number of rants coming up. So can I do my rant first? Because I want to do the rant about Nike and the July 4th. And it comes down to basically, you know, it's our goddamn flag. But let me back into this. Everybody knows the story where Nike, actually, they had a twofer. They not only caved in when Colin Kaepernick complained about the Betsy Ross flag on the tennis shoes and canceled that because that's now a symbol of white supremacy or something. And then they also, turns out that they are also kowtowing to the Chinese who apparently objected to one of their, one of their subsidiaries or one of their vendors who was supporting the democracy movement in Hong Kong. So, you know, here once again we have peak corporate performative wokeness. Say that fast, by the way. But I guess the thing that really got me was, you know, watching on social media all the folks defending Nike because somehow, because a couple of white supremacists someplace had used the Betsy Ross flag, and therefore now it is a symbol of white nationalism here. And my point is, you know, seriously, you know, why do the bigots get to hijack the symbols? I mean, it's not their goddamn flag. It's our goddamn flag, right? I mean, why do we give them veto power over this? I mean, and this is what I wrote in the Bulwark. I said, are we going to let every mouth-breathing, skinhead, proud boy, incel define what symbols we can use? Because you know where this is going, right? Is that any time you have some complete moron who uses the American flag or any symbol of the country, suddenly we go, okay, we can't use that because that's too offensive. And, you know, even though, you know, Donald Trump is going to try to hijack July 4th, that doesn't mean he gets to hijack the country, right? We can still wave the flags. We can still celebrate July 4th just because that, you know, the bleep holes, you know, are trying to appropriate it for their own use. Okay, my rant's over.
Yeah, that was a good rant. Let's see. I would just add a couple of things. One, this controversy, I guess you could call it, is so stupid from start to finish. Because first of all, the shoes are ugly. Like, they're not good-looking shoes. And so I don't know that they were going to be flying off the shelves to begin with. Second of all, you know, I was kind of on Kaepernick's side on the kneeling. I thought, look, if he wants to kneel, he can kneel. I'm not trying to demand that he stand in some way. But this is ridiculous. Like, Nike made the choice to have him as their spokesperson, but now they're going to kowtow to him on this sort of ridiculous moment. But then, just to make sure we were all on every side being dumb, Doug Ducey, who's actually like a really good governor, who's usually very sensible about things and passes a lot of good reforms, he goes and he says, he does like a long Twitter thread about how now Nike is now no longer welcome in Arizona. And so, and they're not going to be giving them, what do they give people to incentivize them to come to their states?
Corporate welfare.
incentives.
Yes, incentives, right. So they're gonna withdraw their incentives for Nike to come. So like they shouldn't be giving them the incentives in the first place. But now they've disinvited Nike from opening a plant in Arizona. So just all down the line, dumbness.
Plus, putting the flag on the sneakers, I'm so old-fashioned. When I first tuned into this controversy, I was several hours late because I hadn't been online all morning. I was actually doing things in the real world. I thought maybe the controversy was about the inappropriateness of putting a flag on a sneaker, which is not a ridiculous, incidentally, point of view. You're kind of not supposed to treat the flag that way. In a sense, we're so far beyond that, I suppose, that it's would be foolish to make too big a deal of it. But so that's what I thought the controversy was about. But I missed, you know, the eight further, or not even further, the eight actual iterations of back and forth stupidity on this, as on so many issues. People just want to get outraged now. They don't want to actually discuss anything, it seems, let alone actually like give the benefit of the doubt to someone they disagree with and have a civilized discussion and a civil society. So that's a little depressing, I've got to say, coming back from Europe yesterday and into this kind of insanity of American politics with Trump trying to ruin the Fourth and this controversy and then about five others I can't even keep track of, all of them pretty bad. I mean, I'll just say this word about Europe. I mean, I was over there in Portugal and Spain. You know, they follow it closely. I mean, they're not, you know, we don't follow Portugal and Spain very closely. They follow the United States closely. They know that their security, their welfare, the welfare of liberal democracy around the world, and those are two countries that for whom liberal democracy is relatively recent, you know, 40, 50 years old, and so they're kind of attentive to this. It depends on the U.S. being strong and capable and confident, and they look at us, they look at the big things, Trump, you know, Trump's foreign policy, and the little things, actually. And they think, is this country kind of reliable? Or are they kind of know what they're doing? Are they going to lead the world in the 21st century?
Not as much as we once did.
So in Spain, so Franco's still dead, though, right? I mean, before...
Yeah, that hasn't changed, you'd be glad to know. And look, it's a wonderful... I don't know it that well, and I don't speak the language much at all, so it's not like I have some deep understanding of it. But Madrid has excellent food, wonderful museums, especially the Prado, of course, which, I don't know, maybe the greatest in the world, I suppose. And the Spanish were good at looting all these other countries for their art.
They
have some great artists, one also has to acknowledge. So the combination is pretty show-stopping. And then and it was 105 degrees there in Madrid. But luckily, unlike 20, 30 years ago, they have air conditioning in most hotels, restaurants, and stuff. So I saw our friend Steve Hayes, Charlie, and his family, and they've had a great year in Spain. He's coming back in about a month, but really cute to see the little kids speaking Spanish and everything, but it really was nice.
Well, that's about time because we miss him. No, the Spanish really did colonialism. They didn't mess around, did they? I mean, when they were colonials, they didn't mess around. By the way, this whole heat wave in Europe, I was just reading this story about how it's so bad that the Germans are actually deciding that maybe we should try air conditioning, because apparently they look down on us for using air conditioning. They think that air conditioning is wimpy in anything, which is, whatever. I want to go back to this outrage and Doug Ducey, because I have a confession to make. Doug Ducey is the governor of Arizona, who I generally like, and he went off on this thread after Nike pulled the Betsy Ross shoes. He said, "Words cannot express my disappointment at this terrible decision. I am embarrassed for Nike. Nike is an iconic American brand and American company. This country, our system of government and free enterprise have allowed them to prosper and flourish. Instead of celebrating American history, the week of our nation's independence, Nike has apparently decided that Betsy Ross is unworthy and has bowed to the current onslaught of political correctness and historical revisionism, shameful retreat, blah, 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 blah. Nike has made its decision, and now we are making ours," and here's the meat, "I've ordered the Arizona Commerce Authority to withdraw all financial incentive dollars under their discretion that the state was providing for the company to locate here. Arizona's economy is doing just fine without Nike. We don't need to suck up to companies that consciously denigrate our nation's history." Okay, now, as you pointed out, conservatives generally don't like the idea of government picking winners and losers. And, of course, there was a widespread objection to when the progressive woke left in Texas tried to punish Chick-fil-A for its politics. But I'm going to confess that viscerally, when I read Doug Ducey's tweets at 5 o'clock in the morning, my defense, I thought, yeah, go for it. Screw him. You know, and it's just how this spreads. And the tone deafness, though. And by the way, I agree with Jim Swift's piece and, Sarah, your point that we shouldn't be punishing companies for content. Actually, I don't think we should have corporate welfare at all. But, I mean, we are just in a... We're just in a weird, stupid new cycle, aren't we?
Yeah, well, I mean, just we can't. Do we have to politicize absolutely everything? Can nothing just be what it is? Like, do I have to feel guilty if I eat at Chick-fil-A? Do I have to take a side of shame with my chicken sandwich? Can I not buy my shoes and have it be politicized in some way? Like, this is where I have a family member who oftentimes I'll say, "Oh, did you see this movie?" "No, so-and-so's in it, and I would never watch something with them in it." And I think, man, their politics might be crazy. Maybe they're a Scientologist. I don't know. But their movies are still good. I just want to exist and enjoy the things I always enjoyed without everything being some kind of crazy virtue signal.
You know, and one point, I mean, and this is to make a maybe an overly serious point, but what are the real arguments for limited government? And one of the arguments against, let's say, governors having slush funds at their discretion to give to corporations was you don't want, I mean, we lived, you know, humanity lived through centuries where everything was politicized, often under the banner of religion in olden times, but also in modern times under other banners, obviously, even worse. And that's not a healthy thing. And the whole point of limiting government and having the rule of law and not letting individual politicians, whether it's Donald Trump or Doug Ducey or anyone else, say, I don't like this company, so they're not getting this benefit, is you don't want to live in that kind of country. That's kind of autocratic and illiberal. And so it does remind one, I've really been struck by this over the last couple of years, that the case for limited government is really a strong case, not just an economic case, a Hayekian sort of, you know, it more efficient, the government will spend money foolishly, government's not good at picking winners and losers, all that kind of stuff, but a really an argument that goes to the kind of society we want and kind of politics we want to have.
A survey that asked even Democratic voters or asked Democratic voters, do you favor a complete and total government takeover of healthcare, even if you know that it means that Republicans like Donald Trump are in charge of it? And that at that point, it's like, whoa, no, we wouldn't want that. We want government control. We want to have this, except we don't want the other side to have it, which is exactly the point that you're making here, why we don't give that much power to government. Okay, I have one more question just to ask on this, which is whether we're capable of being outraged by more than one thing at a time. Because one of the things on social media, of course, is because everything's tribal, is that you cannot possibly be outraged about anything involving Nike unless you have also spent the last week being outraged about the children in cages, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And there seems to be this narrative on social media that unless you are outraged about A, you have no right to be outraged about B, and just the assumption that we're incapable of being outraged about two things at once. Now, Sarah, you're outraged by like 10 things at once, right?
Yeah, I was going to say, I didn't know that this was a difficult thing to do. I can walk and be outraged at the same time.
One of the annoying things about social media, this is Twitter maybe more than anything else, is this kind of, you know, gotcha thing where if you didn't comment on something, someone's outraged that you didn't, as if one might not have millions of opinions. Many of them, in my case, are very well known, and I don't feel the need to rehearse them every time it's a chance to do so on Twitter. I, you know, picked, for whatever reason, maybe intelligently, maybe foolishly, certain issues to focus on Twitter where I think maybe I have a little bit more impact and it makes a little more sense because it's whatever, for whatever reasons. And so I do, but I love it when people say, well, you're criticizing Trump for this, but you didn't criticize AOC or Ilhan Omar for being anti-Israel. Well, you know, I could have, I guess. A, who has time in the day to criticize every politician for doing everything they're doing. B, we only have one president, which is one reason I do focus on Donald Trump. But C, on certain issues, I think my point of view is pretty well known, and I don't think anyone's going to be terribly moved by the fact that Bill Kristol does not think that, you know, does not agree with anti-Israel statements by Ilhan Omar.
Yeah, Charlie, you spend too much time on Twitter. That's the lesson. You just shouldn't let them get to you.
That's true. Somebody had a parody of this, what Bill was just talking about. I think they said, you know, on Twitter today, if you were to tweet out, ducks are nice, somebody is going to answer back, your silence about horses is very telling.
That's good. That's good. Now, that's really true, isn't it?
it is absolutely true. Okay, so I want to talk about what happened over the weekend. I know, Sarah, you talked about this on the quote-unquote secret podcast, but the woke left decided to break up with Never Trumpers, or at least it felt that way over the last several days. We'll be back in a minute, but first, let's talk about sleep. Listen to these studies from Harvard and Johns Hopkins. Chronic sleep deprivation has been shown to lead to depression, diabetes, obesity, and cardiovascular disease because, frankly, we all need 8 hours of sleep, right? Right? You know that. You know how cranky you are if you don't get it. You know how lousy your day is if you don't get 8 hours of sleep. But one of sleep's biggest problems, it's temperature. It's tough to get good sleep if you're too hot or too cold. So I want to tell you about the Pod by 8 Sleep. The Pod by 8 Sleep is a high-tech bed designed specifically to help you achieve optimal sleep fitness. It was developed by leading sleep researchers after tracking 43 million hours of sleep. And here's how it works. It combines dynamic temperature regulation and sleep tracking to enhance your rest and recovery. It learns your personal sleep habits and adjusts the temperature automatically. That means if you like the bed cool, like I do, and if your partner likes the bed warm, well, now you can have both at the same time in a crazy comfortable bed. Sleep longer and deeper so you wake up refreshed and ready to take on the world. So to celebrate Independence Day this year, get a free gravity cooling blanket plus free shipping with your pod purchase. That's a $300 value free. The offer ends next Monday, July 8th. Just visit 8sleep.com/bulwark. That's 8sleep.com/bulwark. Over the last week, there's been this remarkable explosion of commentary. First, I suppose, from Never Trumpers, and I raise my hand here, you know, columns by David Brooks, Brett Stevens, Max Boot. I wrote a couple. Who else was in there? Tom Nichols, Rick Wilson, raising their hands and saying to the Democrats, look, we all want to beat Trump, but you guys might be blowing it if you lurch too hard to the left. And then there's been this counter programming, which basically says, you know, would you people shut up? We don't need to listen to any of you Never Trumpers. We don't need to listen to any of your warnings or any of your advice. Fix your own party, because we're not going to be nominating some mealy-mouthed Democrat. My point is, no, I'm not saying mealy-mouthed. It's just like, why don't you nominate the kind of Democrat who actually wins elections? As opposed to the kind that is going to be, you know, carried through the streets of Burlington, Vermont. So, Sarah, what's going on? Is there a breakup going on right now?
Well, so here's what's happening, right? Which is that their first Democratic debate happened, and so we had 2 nights, 4 hours of Democrats saying a whole bunch of things that cause our conservative, you know, lizard brains to just go haywire. You know, when several of the top tier candidates raise their hands for abolishing private insurance altogether, like, that freaks us out. And it doesn't just freak us out because, you know, we don't like it as a policy. That's true. And we've had common cause with a lot of Democrats over the last couple of years where we haven't shared a policy outlook. But it's because we're making a political calculation that says, hey, guys, we want to beat Donald Trump as badly as you do. And if you lurch so far left that you can't pick up all of the independents hanging out there, sort of reasonable Americans, if they either stay home or they decide, you know what, this economy's just fine. People are overreacting about Trump. The Democrats are crazy. I'm going to vote for him anyway. And we are nervous. And when we express that nervousness, that maybe, hey, guys, maybe think about what it felt like in 2016 at 9 a.m. when you were so, so sure you were going to win. Can you just think for a second about 9 p.m. and how you felt when the whole thing was going south? Because that can happen again if you blow this. And when we sound that alarm, the response is, hey, can you guys shut up? We're not interested in your advice. We don't want to hear this from you. As though, and it is that you're right, that they say, well, go fix your own party. Like, we're not trying, number one. Number two, hey, we're Americans. You know, like, we get to have an opinion on the person who might represent the country.
And also, we are not necessarily as ensconced in the blue bubble as they are. Now, of course, the pushback on your theory, Sarah, is that there are people who say that these swing voters, these middle voters, they're mythical. That there are really no Trumpian voters or soft Trump voters that can possibly be won over. So all we should do is just double down on our base. So, Bill, is that true? Have we really gotten to the point where the politics is no longer about persuasion at all, that there are no voters in the middle, and that we might as well go as, you know, hard and deep into our tribe as possible, that that's the winning solution?
I mean, in theory, it could be, but we know that about 10 million voters switched party preferences between 2016 and 2018. That's why the Democrats won 40 House seats and a bunch of other seats.
Look at your 10 million, yes.
Yeah, your state of Wisconsin. It's not like no one changed their mind, right? So, I mean, now some of it is about turnout. And I don't like it when some of the Never Trumpers may have sounded a little bit like we're petulant, or a couple said, I won't vote for Democrats if they don't do A, B, or C. That may be their personal judgment, but Democrats are entitled to say, okay, well, I'm sorry, this is too important a principle for us for you to vote for us. A lot of people, Charlie, in our day would say, I can't vote for a Republican if they stay pro-life. And at some point, you just say, I'm sorry, that's something we believe in. You're free to have your views, but I'm not going to, so to speak, not that we control it, but we're not going to recommend trading off that view, that principle, for the support of X percent of the electorate. I respect people who say that. They're entitled to say that. But this is the advice they're getting mostly from the people. I was out of the country, so I only read a little bit of it, but your piece and Tom Nichols and stuff was more, it was just analytical advice. It was saying, look, if you want to win the election, it was closely fought last time, it would seem prudent on a couple of these issues not to unnecessarily scare swing voters. And I do think that for me, the health insurance one is very, very big. Some of these other issues, I have views that that may not be appealing to a majority of Americans. I'm not sure that the dovishness of the Democrats, for example, hurts them politically. I think it's bad for the country, and I would argue against it, but I couldn't honestly say that they should sound more like me on foreign policy necessarily, you know? But I do think this is health care and health insurance is a we've had a heck of a lot of experience over the last 10 years in the politics of that issue. And I think we know a lot about it, and there's a ton of public opinion data and a ton of smart social scientists have looked at it. There are very few. Now, I'm not saying, incidentally, over 5 years, that if Elizabeth Warren could make the case to the country, if she gets elected in her second term, that she couldn't put into place a fundamental change in our health insurance from corporate employer provided to a different kind. I'm not even sure I'd necessarily be entirely against that. Corporate employer provided health insurance has problems. But to do it suddenly in an election where it becomes almost the symbol of a kind of recklessness, and you didn't like Obamacare, you didn't like the attempts to repeal Obamacare, everyone's messing around with something, and now suddenly they're really going to mess around with it for 160 million Americans, not just 20 or 30 million. I mean, that is just reckless, I think, politically.
I do too.
And so that's the analysis. Now, if someone wants to make a counter argument that, hey, look at this data from this poll that shows that if people believe understand this, they'll go along with it, maybe. But I mean, I was struck, literally, I've been back 24 hours and two different people I've dealt with, I mean, professionals, I just, you know, literally in passing kind of had conversations with, but they're both, I do know, swing voters. That's what they're alarmed with. I think it's not the style, it's some of the pandering, the wokeness. Everyone understands that's just politics. I don't think that ultimately matters too much. You and I don't like it, but, you know, whatever. But when you take an actual position on an actual issue that every American has a stake in. It's not like health insurance is an abstract issue about, you know, I don't know, something where most people don't really deal with it, right? Even minimum wage, how many Americans have a direct, you know, necessarily stake in that, so to speak. So maybe, okay, pay them a little more, you know, the businesses can afford it. This is people's own health insurance, and you're just telling them, hey, don't worry about it. We're getting everything, government, we know what we're doing. We're going to take it away, but it'll be better. I just think that is such an unnecessary risk for Democratic candidates to take. And look, of the frontier, maybe I'm wrong about this, Biden is not there, but Warren, Harris,
Sanders.
And Sanders are there. So three of the four.
Sanders is sort of, she's gooey on it. She misheard the question.
You mean Harris.
She's trying to back off. But two and a half of the four leading candidates have embraced what is really a politically, I think, dangerous position.
13%. That's the percentage of Americans who support eliminating private health insurance. Not a winner.
No, it is not a winner. It's one thing to promise to give away all kinds of free stuff, which I think is problematic. But when you threaten to take away something as fundamental as that, I mean, I think it ought to be politics 101 that's toxic. And the number that Sarah just cited is key, 13%. Actually, there was a CNN poll yesterday that showed that number was up to 21%. Look, that doesn't matter. It means overwhelmingly this is a terrible idea. Also, you tell people that, hey, you know, we like the idea of involuntary busing. Bring that back. And how about health insurance for illegal immigrants? And we're not just for gun control. We're going to start talking about mandatory gun buybacks, which is confiscation. And we're not just going to defend Roe versus Wade. We're going to be talking about late-term abortions. And we're going to be talking about taxpayer. I mean, it's like in each one of these issues, there's a winning, plausible case that a Democratic candidate can make. And then there are positions that are almost guaranteed to alienate voters in places like, you know, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, Iowa, Wisconsin, et cetera.
Let me also just make one point. I mean, I think busing is so interesting in this because some of these others, like health insurance, is a real issue and it's going to be reformed one way or the other or changed. They'll be put to legislative debates. So I think they've taken a foolish position, but you can see why people feel they have to talk about it. Busing is such an insane thing for them to be getting into. I mean, Harris seized upon it, obviously, is an easy way to attack Biden. But now they've got themselves in a position where they're resuscitating an issue that never, I mean, that was incredibly hot in the 70s, but it really did look before the Milliken decision in 74 that lots and lots of places were going to be subject to involuntary busing, where your kids were going to be not just, I mean, this is happening anyway in some localities, but now it looked like it could be done across district lines by states. Conceivably, the Federal Department of Education would provide incentives or rewards for doing that. And there was just a massive revolt. I'd say of the issues that drove centrist voters to the Republican Party in the 70s at the state and local as well as national level, busing is not a small one. I mean, it's probably in the top five. And it wasn't racism. It wasn't mostly racism, certainly. It was that people had gone through a lot of trouble to get themselves into a place where they kind of liked the schools, and suddenly they were being told, hey, forget about that. We're just taking your kid and sending this, you know, to your second grader to this school or that school. So anyway, it's not an issue. And President Obama was – Barack Obama, who's pretty progressive on these kinds of issues, was president of the United States for 8 years. I don't believe he ever said the word busing. This was not a priority of the Obama education.
I literally had no idea about this debate.
I mean, he was not a priority. It was not even mentioned in the Obama administration or mentioned by, is there a single liberal senator who has said,
ever,
you know what, we need to. And suddenly they're all like getting in line. So what that signals, I think, to normal voters isn't so much that busing is going to come back, which it isn't. It's that they are so intimidated by the left wing of the party that you can't trust them to hold the line on anything. And I do think voters don't like that on either side. It would be the same on the Republican side if someone just looked like he was caving over and over to the right and was scared to ever say, you know, that evolution is probably true just because there's some tiny part of the Republican Party that didn't believe in evolution. I mean, that is bad for a party, but the degree of just collapse on the busing issue, I think, is significant. And again, you put that together with the health insurance thing, which is more of just a policy mistake, I'd say, politically for them. And you do suddenly look at the Democratic Party and think, oh, my God.
Yeah. And let me just make one more point about this, if I could, which is, you know, the idea that I got into this a little bit on Twitter over the weekend because I made some of these suggestions and I just got pounced on by descended on by a bunch of folks on the left. And they made a couple of points that I think are just nuts. And one of them was, well, you've got to appeal to, you need a candidate who can really fire up the base. And I was, no, you have a candidate that fires up the base. His name is Donald Trump. Like, you've got, your base is going to be there to go out and beat Trump. The people that you need to capture are the independents in the center. I mean, there are more people now who identify as an independent than identify with either political party. And so to the extent that those are swing voters or right-leaning independents that want to go after Donald Trump, you should be trying to get them. The other thing is that the other argument people make is around turnout, which is true. You do have to turn out your base. But the thing is that you have to turn it out, not in California. People kept saying this to me. Hillary Clinton did win. She won 3 million more votes in California. Okay, well, I'm sorry. It's not, I'm sorry the Electoral College exists, but like, them's the rules, kids. And like, if you can't get those votes in Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Michigan, it doesn't help you. So that's where you've got to turn people out. And those are the kinds of people who are not going to go for a lot of this really crazy left-wing stuff.
No, I think you're right. And also, Bill, I think your take on the busing thing is exactly right. You know, what we saw, our former colleague John McCormick had a piece in National Review in which Bernie Sanders and Kirsten Gillibrand basically are also saying, hey, we're also open to return to busing, which is nuts, except if you understand that the dynamic here is that nobody wants anyone ever to get to the left of them. So they're constantly sort of sidestepping to the left. And if somebody takes a crazy lefty position, somebody else has to join, even though there's no percentage in it whatsoever. What could possibly go wrong? So let's talk about Joe Biden, because there's an interesting debate, interesting divide, about how badly he was hurt by Kamala Harris's attack on him. I did not think he did as badly as the conventional wisdom. But then the CNN poll came out yesterday showing that he had dropped a full 10 points, which is pretty awful, that Harris had really, you know, jumped up and was within 5 points. Now there are some other polls this morning that suggest that the bleeding wasn't that bad. Give me your sense. Is Joe Biden listing? Is he dead man walking in all of this? How badly has he been damaged by the last week?
You know, so the Morning Consult poll, which came out first, did not have him down by as much as that CNN poll did, and I'm pretty sure it also, the Morning Consult poll had him up with African American voters. So I don't think that it was. I don't think it was devastating for him. I do think, and this is where I disagreed with JVL, and maybe it sounds like with you too, on Joe Biden's performance. I thought Joe Biden really had to come out and demonstrate that he still had his fastball. And that is not what I saw. I saw him, he was doing this thing. This is the thing that I thought was the worst. Kamala Harris comes for him, and he's starting to mount a pretty decent response. But the whole debate, he is minding the clock assiduously and censoring himself. So he'd be on kind of he'd be riding a crest oratorily, and then he'd just be like, oh, my time's up. I need to stop now. And he was like weirdly censoring himself. And it was like somebody had given him the advice, which somebody may very well have. Hey, don't talk unless you have to. Like, we do not need people to see that you have slowed down. And when he was
they've been telling him that for 40 years, and he finally listened to that debate.
I mean, it was weird. And I thought I saw somebody who was being very careful, even though he was indignant and he wanted to fight back. And he had a good line with her about, you know, I became a public defender and not a prosecutor. Still, I didn't think he looked like the Joe Biden who was ready to come out swinging.
Well, and apparently that's a consensus. I actually had the same take that JVL had on that I didn't think he did that badly. I thought he came back rather strongly. He wasn't dottery. He wasn't vague. He wasn't overly defensive. But obviously, other people saw other things. Now, the thing about it, Bill, and you've watched this over the years, though, is there's a cumulative effect in the reaction to the debate, so that, you know, whatever people thought when they were watching the debate, their opinion is shaped by the spin afterwards. And the spin afterwards has been overwhelmingly anti-Biden, overwhelmingly pro-Kamala. I mean, MSNBC, who I dearly love, I mean, they have become Kamala Fest, you know, you know, wall to wall. So you do wonder whether or not this effect is going to intensify over time. So we'll see.
You know. No, I think I couldn't agree more about the way in which these things magnify over the next 24, 48, 72 hours. And the debate had a big viewership, so I didn't see it. I was in Europe, so that normally it magnifies partly because so few people watch the debate and so many more people watch the clips. In this case, quite a few people watch the debate, which I think is worrisome for Biden that he did slide some. I'd say just two things. These debates almost always drag down the front runner some, just because it equalizes the playing field. And what is Biden's big, you know, selling point? He was vice president of the United States for 8 years. All these other people are, you know, first term or second term senators or a couple of governors and stuff. Never been in high executive office as he has. And he was Barack Obama's vice president. But suddenly he's on the stage with them all. And if you're just a normal voter and you look up, the others are as intelligent as he is, as well-spoken as he is, seem to know the issues the same way he does. And suddenly that sort of advantage of stature goes down, just like in every other kind of life, right? If you're on a stage with people, you know, suddenly you're all kind of equal. That's sort of the whole premise of the debate. You all have the same amount of time, as Sarah said, and maybe Biden had more trouble, it was more obviously having trouble confining himself to the time. So I think that some of that erosion was inevitable. I've always thought he was on the weaker side of front runners, which doesn't mean he couldn't win. Mondale was a weak front runner and won George H.W. Bush in a way in 88 in the primaries, but after some troubles, and he still could. But the other thing I would say is what's really striking, though, is as a matter of having been inside a little bit and done some post-debate spin and all that, where were the Biden surrogates and where were the Biden people on background? So far as I could tell, and this was literally like watching, you know, reading stuff from Spain on Twitter and stuff, the Biden people were distancing themselves from Biden's performance, wasn't taking their advice. But literally, was there a single person out there defending him? He has a ton of friends and allies from over the years in Democratic politics. He has a ton of African-American defenders. I think one or two sort of said a word or two in defense. But was there an aggressive campaign? It was obvious that Kamala's people and others as well were on the phone incessantly to every reporter, every TV anchor, everyone else who had a soapbox. Boy, he really flubbed it. Biden really flubbed it. Kamala was great. Where were the Biden people? That makes me worried. I mean, if you want to be pro-Biden, I would be worried about not just Biden himself, but the Biden campaign. It just seems to be very slow on the uptake.
Yeah, I couldn't believe that his staff was out there knocking his performance. I hope that he fires some of those people. They were not. Because the thing is, Charlie, to your point, so I didn't think he did great. I thought Kamala really distinguished herself, although she gave me great reasons to fear her presidency along with that. But he didn't do terrible, right? He wasn't drooling on stage or, you know, and I think that the drop is like Bill said, look, he had a long way to drop and she had a long way to rise, you know, because she was not doing particularly well. So some of that's going to shake up, but he still has a commanding lead. Anybody would rather be in his position than not.
Well, okay, so I was on one of the shows yesterday, and they asked the panel. They said, this was just after the CNN poll came out showing that he had dropped 10 points and she had jumped. The question was, on a scale of 1 to 10, how much should the Biden campaign panic? What would you say, Bill Kristol?
I mean, they shouldn't panic, but they have something to worry about. I mean, I think they need to decide. Are they going
to give me a number? You got to give me a number here. 10 panic,
no,
zero
no.
panic, five?
I'd say a bit more than two or three. I'd say six or seven. I mean, and I just summarize it this way. They have thought, and they may turn out to be right, but they have thought that they could get to the nomination by being showing that he's, you know, capable and not, you know, that he's a young 76 years old, A. B, that he was Barack Obama's vice president for 8 years. And C, that he was is electable, he could win. That was it. That they didn't need to establish any positions, any vision for what he would do as president, and so forth. I think now they need to rethink that. I mean, take health insurance. I would give a speech next week if I were Joe Biden, dwelling on Obamacare, which incidentally is popular among Democrats, reminds people that he was Obama's vice president. He personally negotiated, you know, with a zillion senators and so forth, talking about how he's going to improve it, and saying, with all due respect to my Democratic friends, this notion of replacing private health insurance is both a political loser and very difficult and problematic as a matter of public policy. I mean, if he did that, suddenly we'd be debating that for 3 or 4 or 5 months. He could, if they had a competent campaign, they could get people who were involved in the Obamacare debate to come out and say, yep, Joe was really part of that, and we did some good, and they could have ads with people who benefited from Obamacare on TV. I mean, that's what you would do if you were running. Now, maybe it's a little early. It's only July. Maybe that's what you do in November or December. But I do think the whole campaign has been premised on a kind of, you know, coast to victory that I don't think is going to be possible.
Okay, yeah. Sarah.
I wouldn't panic at all. I wouldn't panic. I think, look, it's too soon to panic. I think they've got some. Look, it's not going to be a coronation, and that may come as that may be startling to them, but that's just not what it's going to be. And he's going to have to get in the mix. But he's got a commanding lead, and I think what Bill said is right. He's got to find some ways to. And this is where I thought he really was having a tough time in the debate was, look, he has every possibility to set the narrative for the Democrats. He can say that these guys are going too far left. He can talk about Kamala Harris, you know, saying that she's going to just rifle off executive orders as a way to deal with policy issues and hit her on that and say that's wrong. But he is going to have to demonstrate something proactively. And it's not just going to be, hey, we all think you're a great guy and you can win, and that's all it's going to take. It's going to take a little bit more than that, but still, not so much more. So I don't think they need to panic, but I do need, they just have to recalibrate a little bit. The biggest thing they need to do is look inward and say, hey, are we standing by our guy or not? Because I thought that what hurt him the most was his staff coming out against him. That was the thing that made them look the weakest.
Yeah, so when I was asked the question yesterday, most of the other folks were saying things like, you know, 9 and 10, you know, on the scale of panic. And I was like, well, wait. This is just the first game. It's not even just the first game. It's like the first inning. Maybe it's the first at bat. So I said 5. And also in part because, despite all of the gushing about Kamala Harris's attack on him, I mean, there's some real problems with it, including the fact that I think she planted this time bomb in her own campaign and maybe in the wider Democratic Party by bringing up the issue of busing, which is now something that's out there. And I'm not sure that in the blue bubble they understand how completely toxic that all is. Also, I think that there's going to be some residual backlash about the sense of the nastiness, the creation of the circular firing squad. I'm not a huge Biden fan, but there's a reservoir of goodwill for him, maybe not in his own staff, but I don't think it's over. Okay, so let's talk about this holiday weekend. And Bill, you had the tweet of the day when you pointed out the last time that a major presidential level figure, decided to associate himself with tanks, and it didn't work out well, did it?
Yeah, I'm old enough to remember that Michael Dukakis in a tank moment in '88, which was part of the general collapse of Dukakis. When he had a real lead over George H.W. Bush, that campaign is a good reminder that campaigns matter, candidates matter. And yeah, you know, we're all a little too deterministic in this age of micro-targeting and social science and, you know, and a shrinking pool, admittedly, of undecided voters to think that it's all just about turnout and demographics. I mean, actually, people do need to have confidence that the president can do the job. I think with Trump, the, you know, I doubt if his numbers will change much one way or the other. I'm just indignant about the July 4th stuff as a Washingtonian or someone who lives just outside Washington. And just the, what it conveys, it's so tacky, the kind of personalizing of it, the politicizing of it, the tanks, the whole thing is such so inappropriate, unnecessary, and just Trump's vanity. And sort of depressing to see the U.S. government, I guess people felt they had no choice, but, you know, kind of just goes along with him and no one resigns in protest. Maybe you wouldn't resign in protest over just a parade, I understand, or a July 4th ceremony. But it's not a good sign that he's doing this. It is a sign of how emboldened he is. And it's a sign of God knows what a second term for Trump would be. That's a point, I think, that Democrats could make a little more effectively about Trump, too, the what it would be like to have a second term of Trump as opposed to just 4 years. Anyway, I think people should enjoy 4th of July. They should do whatever they like to do, whether it's more family-oriented or community-oriented, whether it's parades and celebrations or just backyard barbecues, and they should ignore Trump and remember that the 4th of July is about a lot more than Donald Trump giving a speech.
See, everything's politicized now, Charlie. This is
everything.
The problem. We can't even have 4th of July. We can't go out of the mall and watch some fireworks. What? Now we've got to have tanks rolling down the streets. I mean, if you're somebody who's a little bit worried about Trump's, you know, authoritarian tendencies, the tanks in the military parade do nothing to inspire confidence. Okay. Man, it's all depressing. Just
okay,
like
let me throw out a non-political question for the topic for you guys. So, Sarah, how do you feel about Take Your Daughter to Work Day?
Well, it was wonderful when my dad took me to his law firm, you know, one day a year to give me, wasn't like I got any responsibility, but if you're Donald Trump and you take Ivanka and you're basically like, here, sit with all the presidents and please feel free to opine at will with all of these heads of state, you've earned it, darling.
This would be like your dad not only taking you to the law firm but taking you to court with him.
Yep, let me try a case.
You know, I hadn't focused on that clip. I did see it obviously later on online of Ivanka trying to sort of butt into that conversation between, I think, the IMF head Lagarde and who was it, Theresa May and Merkel maybe, and someone else, Macron, I guess.
Macron.
And, yeah, and someone pointed out at this in Spain, who I met, a diplomat actually noticed this. I said, someone said, wasn't that amazing? They were all talking about just how, you know, awful it was and embarrassing for the U.S. And I said, yeah, how did they get that? I guess that was, I, you know, where did they get the footage or something? I can't remember how I put it, you know, I guess. And someone said, the French released it, not just the French, the office of the French presidency. So, I mean, Macron's office released that video that we've all seen of Ivanka desperately trying to sort of insert herself in that conversation. And that does say something about what they, I mean, they're just trolling Trump, I suppose, and taking a bit of a shot at him. But no, but it's really embarrassing. I mean, that the degree of that she and Jared, that Trump thinks it's great. And look, I honestly, I mean, I joked about this on Twitter. I think several other people did too. Trump wants her to run for president in 2024.
Oh, yeah.
I think there's zero chance that that's not true. And I think there's not, and if he's reelected or if he has a good campaign and falls a little bit short, and then half or two-thirds of the Republican Party says we've got to have a sort of better, younger version of Trump in 2024, Mike Pompeo and Mike Pence and all these other characters think they're going to be the heir to that, you know, Trump lane of the Republican Party. But the Trump machine is going to fall in behind Ivanka, and we'll all laugh at it, and then it'll turn out that some percentage, maybe, I hope not, of the Trump supporters are really in such a cult of personality sort of mode that they'll fall in with her too.
She'll have to climb over Don Jr.'s body first. I think they both want it, which is...
Yeah, but she's clearly... It was the fact that it's her. She's clearly the designated favorite child. Okay, let's talk about peeing in the streets, okay? Because
really?
We have
I'll
to,
let you guys do that. Don't,
no,
you
no,
to
no,
do
no,
some
no.
work here, Charlie?
Here. So Tucker Carlson is... interviewing the president, says, you know, you've come to, you know, where we are now, Osaka or Tokyo, and these cities are clean. There's no graffiti. Nobody is going to bathroom on the, going to the bathroom on the street. You don't see junkies. Trump says it's very nice, isn't it? Carlson, very different from our crappy cities and everything, you know, like New York, San Francisco, Los Angeles. They got a major problem with, it's very, very sad, with filth. Carlson says, why is that? And the president of the United States says it is a phenomenon that started 2 years ago. It's disgraceful. I'm looking at it very seriously. We're going to do some things you've probably noticed, like some of the very important things that we're doing now, but we're looking at it very seriously because you can't do that. And apparently police officers are becoming sick just by being near homeless people. So I don't know, Sarah, 2 years ago,
Did something happen 2 years ago?
Make America pee in the streets again. I mean, what?
I think what he's, I'll tell you, I mean, I was thinking about this a little bit when I read it. I mean, he's probably thinking something he vaguely heard like 4 or 5 years ago. De Blasio, I mean, he's in New York, right? So De Blasio changed Giuliani and Bloomberg's policies about the homeless, and that there are more homeless in New York now, and it is more of a problem. San Francisco really is bad. And he read something vaguely about those mayors, to, you know, changing policies. And then he's like, you know, garbled it in his usual way. I do think someone made this point recently, and I kind of dismiss all this psychological, psychiatric stuff and, you know, mental competency stuff. I just don't like that kind of argument typically. But I mean, the notion that he is garbling things more than he used to and that it's even more of a word salad than it used to be, I don't think that's entirely false, you know.
No.
Yeah, he's got those ruts in his brain that he, like, goes to. But here's one thing that I think we can definitely say, which is that Trump's little jaunt abroad here is corresponding with the Women's World Cup. And he got in a fight with, like, the star of the women's soccer team, Megan Rapinoe, who just scored 2 goals against France to send us to the semifinals. And I'm just going to stand for her and say that women's U.S. Soccer representing us in the world quite a bit better than Donald Trump has been.
Oh, yes, absolutely. No, by the way, but going back to the point about whether or not Donald Trump is losing a couple of steps, go back and watch some of those interviews that he gave in the early 1980s. He actually speaks in complete sentences. There are coherent thoughts. There are discernible thoughts. They may be wrong. They may be offensive. But there is something that's going on with him. I just find it interesting that Tucker Carlson is going to this, let's compare America negatively to Japan, because, you know, another sign that somehow we have failed. We are this decadent culture. And, of course, in certain neighborhoods of Los Angeles, you could certainly make that case. But it is interesting how he's advancing that particular line. You know, we're having this conversation on Tuesday, just a few days after Donald Trump once again was sucking up to Vladimir Putin, MSB, Kim, virtually every thuggish authoritarian in the world. And yet it feels like it's okay, whatever, it's same old, same old. And we've almost, you know, Bill, we've gone into this Trump doctrine where there's really no moral content to American leadership anymore. And it feels like it's almost irreversible at this point, and that we've gone along almost with a despairing shrug.
I don't know.
It's all transactional.
Yeah, I mean, I hope it's not irreversible, but I would say that was the main concern of the people I talked to in Spain. And then before that, I was in Portugal at a conference with lots of Europeans. And they are worried about American leadership, American will, American policy, but actually about what you just mentioned. Do we have any sense anymore in America that there's a difference between autocrats and democracies and liberal democracies? And I said, yes, we do. Our president doesn't much. And in fact, if anything, he seems to personally prefer the autocrats. I mean, Tucker Carlson, you know, a big shot now on the American right, thinking nothing of dumping on the biggest cities in America, and incidentally, the cities that house an awful lot of American leadership in tech and other industries, dumping on them by comparison with Japanese cities because they're cleaner. Now, they may be cleaner, and maybe there are things we can learn from Japanese cities and from other cities, but in the old days, American conservatives were kind of prickly about that and would have can you imagine if President Obama had said, you know, President Obama's favorite interviewer had a colloquy where they agreed that, you know, those Scandinavian cities are so much better kept up than these grubby American cities. Everyone would have had a heart attack on the right. And instead, so what's depressing isn't just Trump, it's Trump's acolytes or followers like Tucker. Tucker will run in 2024, too, for the Republican nomination, so that'll be exciting if he runs against Ivanka. Maybe he'll be her vice presidential pick. And, you know, and not just there, but then all the rationalizers and enablers, they wouldn't really sign on to this kind of thing, but they certainly didn't say anything. I mean, maybe I missed it, but were there a lot of Republicans complaining about the unbelievable, moral capitulation to Kim
No.
and to Putin
No.
and to MBS and all of them?
No, I think that after he reversed himself on the Chinese telecom company, Marco Rubio pushed back and said that there was going to be congressional action, but there was, do you see anything at all on North Korea?
No, I saw people like Laura Ingraham, who, used to criticize Obama for these things. The thing is, they're all delusional. What they say is like, can you believe this guy? Look how awesome it is. He put his toes into the DMZ. This is a new frontier. I can't believe this kind of American leadership. It is crazy town.
Yeah, and the juxtaposition of what they said during the Obama presidency and what they are saying now is, shall we say, a little bit revealing. Well, listen, I want to thank both of you for spending time with us, and I hope you have a great July 4th holiday, tanks and Trump's speech notwithstanding. So thank you very much, Sarah and Bill.
Thanks for
Charlie.
The memories.
Happy 4th.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.